भाई वो बहनों, नए फाइनेंशियल ईयर में हम लाए हैं आपके लिए नए सब्सक्रिप्शन प्लान्स। इसमें नेशनल प्लान्स हैं, इंटरनेशनल प्लान्स हैं। देखिए, हम यूट्यूब का ज्वाइन बटन उपयोग में नहीं लाते हैं, इसलिए हमने ये सब्सक्रिप्शन प्लान्स बनाए हैं जिनसे हम एक कॉर्पस फंड बना रहे हैं जो हमारे राष्ट्रीय और हिंदू हितों में काम लिया जाएगा। और इसमें नेशनल प्लान्स आरम्भ होते हैं 100 रुपये से और इंटरनेशनल प्लान्स आरम्भ होते हैं $5 से। इनके सबके डिटेल्स विस्तार से आपको डिस्क्रिप्शन में मिल जाएंगे, वहाँ जाइए और क्लिक कीजिए। साथ ही हमारे इस अप्रतिम अभूतपूर्व कंटेंट के लिए आप हमें सहायता तो करते ही हैं। ऊपर जो आपको दाहिने हाथ में टॉप पर जो QR दिख रहा है, उसको स्कैन करके हमें फाइनेंशियली सपोर्ट करते रहिए, जिससे हम ये अभिनव कंटेंट आपके लिए लाते रहें। नमस्ते, आप सभी का स्वागत है आज के इस कार्यक्रम में। और आज हमारे साथ हैं काला भाई वेंकट जी, आप जानते हैं, पहले आ चुके हैं जयपुर डायलॉग्स पर। काला भाई वेंकट जी से आज हम बात करेंगे राम जन्मभूमि और उसके ग्लोबल इम्पैक्ट, ग्लोबल रिएक्शंस और एक तरह से एक ग्लोबल पर्सपेक्टिव, उसके बारे में बात करेंगे। तो आपका स्वागत है काला भाई जी, वेलकम टू द जयपुर डायलॉग्स।
नमस्ते संजय जी, जय श्री राम, स्वागत एवरीवन।
जय श्री राम, जय श्री राम। तो राम जन्मभूमि के जो है, ये भारत में तो बहुत बड़ा इवेंट था, बाहर ये कैसे देखा गया? व्हाट वाज द रिएक्शन अब्रॉड?
सो अमंग द मोमिंस इट हैज बीन अ डबल वैमी, सो दे आर इंप्लोडिंग, क्योंकि पहले यहां प्राण प्रतिष्ठा हुआ था, then Modi ji went to UAE and then he consecrated the Swaminarayan Mandir. So that was, you know, adding insult to injury for a lot of Momins, and they are exploding. And one of them is Yasir Qadhi. I do not know whether our audience are familiar with him. So maybe we can start with who he is and how he reacted to this and how do we respond to that. Correct?
Okay.
All right. So Yasir Qadhi is a sheikh and imam. Okay, he is of Pakistani origin, but he was born and brought up in the US. But he also lived for many years in Saudi Arabia. He went to Medina. So he is one of the very fundamentalist Muslim imams. He studied in Medina. Then he goes to Yale University, where he does his PhD. So he has got this external trappings of an academic, right? So he's having a PhD, went to Yale University. But three of his students are also convicted jihadis.
Okay, so
he's a very interesting character because when we talk about Hindu scholars, you know, they are mostly those very, you know, very formal, very academic type people. But our Islamic scholars are very different. Okay, so three of them are, you know,
they practice what they preach.
Yeah, they practice what they preach. Okay, and one of them was the most famous. You know, he was the infamous underwear bomber. His name was Umar Abdul Muttalib. Okay, have you heard of him?
Not
so in the,
can't recall so in the, offhand.
Yeah. So he's of Nigerian origin, and then he carried a plastic explosive in his underwear and he tried to get on a plane. I think it was in Amsterdam.
Yes, I remember it.
Yeah, and he was trying to blow it up, and he was a student of Yasir Qadhi. Okay, pakda gaya, and then, you know, the jihadi went to jail, and I hope he's still rotting in the jail until this day, because Americans chhodte nahi aise logon ko. Then, second was, his second jihadi student was a Somali Al-Qaeda fighter. Okay, so, wo bhi pakda gaya, okay, he was also caught. Okay, so, that's number two. And then third was another jihadi who wanted to become a sniper, and he wanted to train his gun on an American mall and kill some shoppers and innocent people. So he was also caught. So I do not know what you call a person, three of whose students are convicted jihadis, suicide bombers and whatnot. So I think for the lack of better words, shall we call him a living room jihadi? Because there are two types of jihadis. Ek to field jihadi hai. So they go and they blow up the places, and then they carry plastic explosive in their underwear. They try to blow up the airplanes, you know, shoot people in the ball and everything. Then there is another type, which are the living room jihadis. They justify everything. They inspire these field jihadis. So let's call Yasir Qadhi, an Islamic theologian, come living room jihadi.
Right.
Okay. So in 2011, New York Times carried a very extensive article about him. And they said a lot of his students write to him about jihad, asking him what kind of jihad they should be waging. And he advised them, if you are in the United States or in the civilized world, then you should wage the jihad of the tongue, meaning jihad of the pen. Okay, so you brainwash everyone, you know, you glorify jihad, and then you radicalize as many people as they can. I think that's the meaning of jihad of the tongue. And then if you are in the Muslim world, he used a very particular phrase. I had actually noted it down. Dekho, kya hai? So he said, if you are living in other countries, then the responsibilities of the Muslims would be different. That means they have to wage a different type of jihad, which I mean is actually killing people. Okay, so that is Yasir Qadhi for you. And then a couple of years back, he also landed himself in a controversy. He declared, I think he was a bit caught unaware. So he, because I think his email was leaked and all of that stuff happened. So he said, the standard Islamic narrative has holes in it. Okay, that
has holes in it.
Yeah, has holes in it. Okay, so the standard Islamic narrative is, look, you know, the Quran has an uninterrupted transmission. You know, it was perfectly as revealed at the time of Muhammad, and it has been perfectly preserved and everything. And of course, we all know that's not the case. You know, anyone who has studied the history of Quran and the text and everything, we all know that's different. But Muslims don't believe that. But when it comes from an imam,
we even know where it is adapted from.
Exactly, we know that. Okay, so we know, you know, where all they copied it from and which Syriac text they copied from. We know all of those things. Yes, but Muslims,
all that Ginza Rabba and everything, that all comes into it.
Exactly. But when it comes from one of their own imams and one of their most respected conservative fundamentalist scholars, that sends shockwaves around the Islamic world. So he landed himself in trouble. Okay, so that is Yasir Qadhi for you. Okay, so
yeah, actually, you know, this Qadhi, when they write DH in Urdu, standard Urdu is pronounced as Z.
Qadhi, so right?
Qazi, but since he is trying to be an Arab, so he changes it to DH instead of Z. Like Zimma is pronounced as Zimma.
Acha, I didn't Zimmi know. Okay.
Zimmi in Urdu is Zimmi.
That's correct. Yeah, Dimi is Zimi. That I am
so
aware of.
Riyadh, what you say, Riyadh is actually pronounced in Urdu as Riyaz.
Acha. Okay, then this would have become Qazi in that case, right?
Yeah, Qazi. Okay. And Abu Dhabi. We call Abu Dhabi, but it's pronounced in Urdu as Abu Zabi.
Got it.
Like that's Ramadan and Ramazan. Okay.
Got it. Okay. All right. I was not aware of this linguistic parallels they had between Urdu and Arabic. Okay, that's informative. Thank you. So, about a month ago, Yasir Qadhi, he released a video, and it's there on the on YouTube.
Yes,
the title of the video, the title of the video is, you brought it up. All right, very good. Okay, so he says the tragedy of Babri Masjid. Okay, so you know, it's not a tragedy for Hindus that Babri Masjid was built in the first place. Babri Masjid gaya wahan pe Ram Mandir aa gaya, so that is a tragedy for them. Okay, and then he also rails and rants a lot about Hindustan, our history, and all the usual stuff we hear from the Marxist historians, that you know, there was no India to begin with, and you know, it's all the gift of Muslims. And and of course, he'll blabber a lot. He will say things like, you know, Aurangzeb created India. Okay, and
Aurangzeb is the father of India, is it?
Yeah. He's the father of India. And he makes statements like, you know, no other Indian king even ruled 1/6 of the empire that Aurangzeb ruled, and all he had to do is search for the empire of Ashoka.
If history begins only from
632, exactly.
Obviously, nobody has ruled before that.
Yes, of course.
It cannot be any Chandragupta Vikramaditya or Chandragupta Maurya. Or,
No Choras, no Pallavas.
And of course, Shri Ram and Shri Krishna are mythical figures anyway.
Of course. And then we don't have anything like Bharat Varsha and all these things. And anyway, that's where he started. And then he laments throughout the video. And as part of that he makes four arguments. ये एक-एक करके उसको dissect करें.
बिल्कुल.
Okay. So the first one he starts with, there is no evidence for the existence of Bhagavan Rama, and nobody other than the Hindus believe that Rama is God. This is his first argument. Okay. So, and of course, all he had to do is to look at the converse of this argument.
He doesn't reckon that Buddhists also regarded him as one.
Of course, for him, it doesn't matter, right? Everyone is kafir. Okay, Buddhist, Hindu, mein kya farak padta hai? Okay, dono kafir hai. Okay, so if Jains, Hindus, Buddhists, they all recognize, and the Sikhs, they all recognize, you know, Rama as God, it does not matter to them, right? So, you know, for example, in, what was it, 1857 or 58, when the Nihang Sikhs, they came, they attacked 1858, right? And then they, you know, installed the image of Sri Rama, and then they did havan, everything inside the mosque. So it doesn't matter to Yasir Qadhi. For Yasir Qadhi, except Hindus, nobody recognizes Rama as God. And there is no evidence for the existence of Bhagavan Rama. Okay. And of course, I do not know how anybody will prove the existence of God. And the same argument can be turned around its head and directed at Islam too. Because they cannot prove the existence of Allah. And of course, we know that, you know, the pre-existing pagan god Allah became Allah, and of course, you know, Christians and Jews also use the word in Arabia Allah to refer to their gods. But then, you know, apart from that, there is no proof. Okay, there is no proof that any god exists, and Allah also, we do not have any proof that he exists. But of course, you know, the argument has a deeper meaning, right? The meaning is, it starts with the Shahada, Ya ilahi illallah Muhammad Rasulullah. That is, you know, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his final seal of the Prophet. And that means they have to deny the existence of every other divinity. Okay, they have to deny the gods of Hinduism. And that's why he makes that statement. And when they say that, they also emulate the example of Muhammad. And that example is, since these are all false gods, we are perfectly justified in demolishing their temples. And that's what Muhammad did. You know, he goes to Mecca, and then he attacks the shrine of pagans, which has 360 idols and people are worshipping. It's an active place of worship. And then he turns it into an active crime scene by, you know, decapitating those idols and, you know, tossing them out and everything. He takes over. So the message here, the implied message, which all of his Muslim audience understand, is this is a false god. And then hence, the Ram Janmabhoomi Mandir, the original Mandir, deserves the same fate that the Mecca pagan temple suffered. Okay, which means, you know, you can go and desecrate that, and you can erect a mosque on top of that, or you can convert that into a mosque. And that's the message. Okay. So, and of course, the implied here is also the very arrogant supposition that Allah is all powerful and mighty. And that's why we are able to go on and, you know, inflict all this pain and suffering and damage on the temples of the kafirs. That's the message, right? And even if you look at Chachnama and other things, that's urging it, right? You know, Qasim comes to India because he was so full of faith. You know, a 17-year-old Qasim was able to lay waste to the kingdom of Raja Dahir, and then, you know, massacre all of these Hindus, and then hence arise Muslims. Let's do the same thing to the Hindus. So implied here is the message that Allah has bestowed us with all the power and all the might. And that's why, you know, if we had demolished the temple, who cares? It's anyway a temple of false god, and it deserved that fate.
Even though they lost the caliphate.
They lost the caliphate.
To the kafirs.
Not only the caliphate. 930 mein, jab Abu Tahir aaya tha wahan pe. So Abu Tahir, you know, was the Karmatian, right? Those are the very militant, yes, Shia sect. So Abu Tahir invades Mecca, okay, and he gives Muslims the same treatment Muhammad had earlier given the pagans, okay, and later on the Muslims would give the same treatment to the Hindus.
But takes away the holy stone.
He takes the holy stone, okay. He does two things. He first quotes Quran, you know, 397, where Allah says, this is Masjid al-Haram, and then I have made it safe for the Muslims. And then he comes, he enters the place during Hajj, he kills all the pilgrims and throws their dead bodies into the Zamzam well, and then he recites 397. He says, Allah has made this place safe. Okay, look how safe it is now. Okay, then he takes that stone. He takes that stone from Kaaba. Oh, leke chala gaya Bahrain, leke gaya udhar. And then in Bahrain, he puts it in the toilet commode. Okay, And then he, you know, people used it for defecating, urinating, everything for the next 22 years. Okay, usko tod diya, he breaks into 7 pieces, and then he uses it for this purpose. Then after 22 years, he bundles it back, puts it in a sack, and throws it into the masjid in Kufa. Okay, and then he says, along with a note, I took it away, now I have returned it, do what you want. And now Muslims, they bring it back to Kaaba, they stitch the 7 pieces together, they put it there, and now they are back in Hajj pilgrimage, they are going there, they are worshipping it, they are kissing it, and everything. Not realizing for a minute, for 22 years, that was the toilet commode, okay, of Abu Tahir and Karmatians, okay. But then, you know, the likes of Yasir Qadhi do not realize that, you know, the kind of treatment, the violence they inflict upon the believers of other religion has been inflicted upon their holiest shrine in Mecca, okay, without the Muslims even realizing. At least there is a difference. We Hindus, when they came and destroyed about 40,000 temples, we remembered that, okay, and then it was a tragedy, and we are only overcome militarily but not spiritually. And we all the time, we fought back and we got it back. But Muslims who are going to Mecca don't even know, okay, the stone they are kissing where it had been before.
Actually, there's a fundamental problem here, you know what?
Mm-hmm.
See, under the, what is called the, our dharmic traditions, deity is forever.
Right.
And the deity can be housed in a murti. The murti can be broken, can be stolen away, but the deity remains. So that is the fundamental supposition as yeah. far as Hinduism is concerned. And it is also recognized under Hindu law, right. also recognized by the Indian Supreme Court,
right.
also was also recognized in the Ram Janmabhoomi temple decision. They specifically mentioned that particular case. It's known as the Ram Janaki Mandir case.
Correct.
They mentioned it there.
Yeah.
There are other cases also. So, as far as Hindus are concerned, there's always a case, okay? So what if you built a mosque over there? The deity Correct. Remains. The place Correct. Belongs to the deity. The deity Exactly. is forever.
Yeah. Exactly.
Unless there is a proper visarjan, the deity will remain there.
Exactly. That's correct. That's
Whereas, as far as Muslims are concerned, according to their theology, first of all, why are they kissing a stone?
Yeah. Exactly. That is a stone picked up from the toilet commode of Karmatians.
Yes. So it becomes desecrated, because if you tear away a page of Quran, it becomes desecrated.
Correct.
So a stone, a holy stone broken, gets desecrated. So how right. can they use it again? So that is my yeah. point.
Yeah. And not only that, right? So and yeah, in spite of all of this arrogance, right, you know, Allah has empowered us, and, you know, nothing can happen to Mecca. Mecca is safe, everything. The Karmatians in 930, they come, and right in Mecca, they say, look, we have debunked your Allah. We have debunked your Quran, right? That's what he's saying. Now, of course, when the counter to this argument could be that if someone like Yasir Qadhi thinks that Hindu gods are false, and hence we can totally trample your belief, and we can come and desecrate your temple, demolish your temples and build mosque on top of that, can the same not be done to their mosques? I'm not recommending that. We won't do that. Okay, you know, we Hindus, we may disagree with Islam as a religion. We may disagree with the theology of Islam. But then Hinduism is not about destroying other places of the place of worship of other religions.
The Spaniards did it.
The Spaniards did it. Karmatians did it. But we have not done that, right? And that's not in our way of thinking, and we are not recommending that. But what amazes me is all of these Islamic fundamentalists and fanatics, you know, who are so convinced of jihad and who are so blindly advocating destroying the temples of other people, don't pause for a minute and think, what if others use the same methods on us? What if they came and demolished our mosques? What if they demolished Mecca and Medina? And what if they demolished the mosque on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. They don't think about it for a moment. Okay, so there is a complete lack of opposite thinking. There is a complete lack of empathy.
I'll add to that. I'll add to that. In, I think, 1805, the people from Najd, these same Saudis, had occupied Mecca, and I think they it remained occupied for about 10 years.
Right.
And they did white desecration even at that time.
Yeah.
And again, even today, 1925, it is not under Muhammad's descendants, the Hashmis.
Are in Jordan, Dona, right? They are not even in Saudi.
They are in Jordan. They are in Jordan. And this is again occupied by the Najdis.
Yeah.
It is Dine Hijazi.
मुझे लगता है हमारा एमबीएस उसको टीक करने वाला है अभी.
In account after account, it is not known as Islam initially. It's known as Dine Hijazi.
Yeah.
The religion of Hijaz.
Yeah.
And that Hijaz is no more. The Hijaz is Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Exactly. So anyway, I think Mohammed bin Salman is on the way to fixing it, because already, you know, the children cannot be taken to mosques, and they have started teaching excerpts from Ramayana, Mahabharata, and everything. I think I'm looking forward to it.
They are ahead of India, even India.
They are ahead of India. Mujhe lagta hai, just like that, we have Dakshin, Kashi and all these things in India, and we have this Rameshwaram in South India. All of these are, you know, Dakshin, instances of the temples in North India. We are going to have very soon a Pashchim Ram Janmabhoomi in Saudi Arabia. That will make the Mormons totally implode. Okay, that will be going nuclear. Okay,
they're so already hurting after this Abu Dhabi temple.
Abu Dhabi temple is literally hurting them. So anyway, that was his first argument. The first argument was, you know, Rama did not exist, and it's not a real god, and nobody but Hindus believe it. And implied here is, so what, you know, if somebody had demolished the temple? And, you know, we can always respond, you know, beta, jaake dekho Abu Tahir ne kya kiya 930s AD mein. Okay, so, and the stone you are kissing in Kaaba, that will tell the full story for you. Okay, so second argument he makes is, no temple existed beneath the mosque. Okay, and some of the arguments he makes are so ridiculous that even he should be embarrassed about making those arguments. He says, no good scholar accepts on, you know, good evidence that there was a temple beneath the mosque. And when the archaeologists dug that place, they found some bones.
So what logic does he follow? The Quranic logic or scientific
logic? Islamic logic. Or kuch nahi hai. Matlab, argument aap dekhiye. Argument dekhiye.
Islamic when logic is simple. Islamic logic is very plain. Whatever is written in the book is true. That's all.
It's a truth claim, right? There is no logic in Islam. It's only a truth claim. Yeah, and but he argues, when the archaeologists dug under the mosque, all they found was some bones. Okay. And, even the Marxist historians of India would be ashamed of making an argument like that. But this guy doesn't have any shame. But I think when you have trained enough jihadis, three of whom are convicted, you know, becoming underwear bombers and everything, I think whatever shame a normal human being has would have left you, would have abandoned you. Okay, so he makes that statement. So, Mene Socha, why don't we at least present some of the evidence, which, some of our top scholars, like, you know, Meenakshi Jain, Professor Meenakshi Jain, Professor B.B. Lal, B.R. Mani, K.K. Mohammed, and many others have summarized, you know, Coin Rod Elston and others have summarized. But why don't we summarize a few of those, Kane?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there were two major phases of excavation, right? The first one was done by Professor B.B. Lal and his team, and K.K. Mohammed was part of that team as well. That was in 1976-77. That's when it started. And in fact, it was only published in the Archaeological Survey publications, and it was not even known to the public until the Marxist historians started doing false propaganda from 1989. That's when, you know, Professor B.B. Lal came out and made all of those available in the public domain, in the popular domain. But anyway, second one was, you know, after the Babri masjid was demolished in 1992, that the dome and everything was demolished. Then the second excavation was led by Professor B.R. Mani, again one of the topmost archaeologists of India. So between these two excavations, they brought out so much evidence. And, you know, in the words of Professor Meenakshi Jain, we have hundreds and hundreds of pieces of evidence that testify to the existence of temple dedicated to Sri Rama, which was demolished and upon which the mosque was built by Babur, and zero evidence to the contrary, meaning zero evidence that tells that there was no temple and the mosque was built on virgin soil. That was the argument made by the Marxist historians, you know, Romila Thapar and that gang of four, Irfan Habib, R.S. Sharma, D.N. Jha, four charlatans, four frauds, you know, whose knowledge can be written on a pinhead and still you'll have enough room to accommodate the trash written by other Marxist scholars. Okay, but then, you know,
add to this, or maybe you might know it already, because this excavation, these ASI findings are also covered in the Ram Janam Bhoomi judgment.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure you would have read it.
Yes, I have read that.
Yes.
Kunal also summarized that quite extensively.
In India, there's a variation. The variation is because they say that no evidence was found of temple demolition. Now, in a way, it is like, you know, saying that the absence of proof is the proof of absence.
Yeah.
That's what they are arguing here, because the Supreme Court says that, okay, the ASI has clearly established that there was a very large structure beneath the mosque, which was a temple, but they have not established whether it was built, the mosque was built after abolishing it, after demolishing it.
Yes, but let me clarify that point. You know, Professor B.R. Mani,
that is only a circumstantial evidence. So ASI doesn't give a clear finding on that, because it's not a black and white case like it is in Kashi.
Actually, Professor B.R. Mani clarifies that, okay, in one of his extensive interviews as well as in one of the publications. So, but here is what he points out. Okay, so what happens, you know, you have these pillars, right, right on top, and then below the pillars, there were the pillar bases. Okay, the base was always a little wider than the pillar itself. That's why, that's, you know, the base is made of bricks. And then he points out the pillar was severed from the bases. Okay, it was cut and taken out from the base. That's actually proof that the temple was demolished and the mosque was stood up on top of that, because these pillars were reused in the mosque. In fact, that's one of the many evidences. Like, for example, there are 12 pillars inside the mosque, and all of those 12 pillars had been cut from the base and then they had been put inside the temple. And, you know, at the bottom of the pillar, you have this Purna Kalasham, right? The Purna Kalasham is one of the Ashtamangala Chinnam in Hinduism, because it's one of those auspicious symbols or signs, okay? So, which you will find all of the, in all of the pillars inside the temples. So, what they have done at the time of building the mosque was to cut the pillar out and put it inside and then put some plaster of Paris on top of that on one side, but still on all the 12 of the pillars inside the mosque, B.R. Mani and his team, again, K.K. Mohammed was part of the team. He also explains that in one of his interviews. So they had 12 of those. All of those had been severed. That's actually telltale proof that it was demolished by the builders of the mosque, and then the same material was used. Okay.
Right.
Then you have two more pillars right outside the mosque, and these 14 were already identified by B.B. Lal himself, right, in the very first discovery. Then when B.R. Mani starts excavating, now they can use, after, you know, 1992, since the mosque has been brought down, they can use excavating equipments, bulldozers and everything. They now start digging. They go several feet below. I forgot how many feet. Was it 14 feet or 24 feet? Something like that, right? They go below. That's when they cut through many layers of that, you know, starting with the post-Mughal layer, the Mughal layer, then they go back to the Rajput layer, then the Gupta period, then the Shunga period, then the period all the way up to 7 BCE. That's where, you know, the northern painted graveware period of Bibi Lal and the parallels with Chitrakuta, then, you know, Shringavarapura and all of those things they find below that. And then way below that, they go up to 1300 BCE. Okay, that's the oldest layer up to which they go. And then what they find at this stage in 1992, when they start the excavation, B.R. Mani finds another 50 more pillars outside. So in all, 64 pillars, load-bearing pillars, supported the temple. That tells you how massive that temple would have been. Okay. So, and all of these pillars have been dated by Professor B.B. Lal and subsequently by Professor B.R. Mani to 1100 AD. So that is about 12th century. That's at the beginning of the 12th century. This is evidence number one that a temple was demolished, and then right on top of the temple, this Babri Masjid was built by reusing the very own pillars, including the Ashtamangala Chinnam, which is the Purna Kalasham of the temple. At the base of these pillars, they were all reused by Babur and his marauders in building the temple. That was evidence number one. Then evidence number two is Makara Pranali, right? Makara is crocodile, and Pranali is roughly translate means a water channel, right? So, you know, when you go into the Garbhagraha of the temples, what they have is they do all the Abhishekam, okay, with water, with milk and honey and all of these things. And then they start collecting at the bottom. And from there, they go through this Makara Pranali. And from there, they flow northward towards Sarayu River. They found this entire Makara Pranali. Again, nobody in his sane mind will think that a mosque will have Makara Pranali. And this comes straight out of a temple. And these guys demolished. But then in the they did not even remove all the evidence from the crime scene. So that's why we are able to go back and find that.
The operative word is sane mind.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, you cannot have a sane mind and then become a Muslim, and even on top of that cannot become a Ghazi, right? And, Babur described himself as a Ghazi. Okay, so he declared that, you know, I'm a Ghazi and I'm here to destroy Hinduism and destroy their temples and everything. Yeah, you are absolutely right. Nobody in their sane mind would have done all these things. That's what they did. But that's evidence number two. Evidence number one was the pillars. The pillars with all of the Purna Kalasham at the base of the pillar. And then number two evidence is Makara Pranali, which is only there in Hindu temples. And then number three is Amalaka. Amalaka is the disc. You know, when you look at the temple, so you have the tower of the temple on the Gopuram, right?
And on you the have Shikhar.
You have the Shikhar of the temple, and then you have the Kalasha on the top, and right below the Kalasha, you have this disc, right? And that disc is known as Amalaka. So even like some of the South Indian viewers of this program, if they have been to temples like, you know, Pattadakalli, okay, for example, in Karnataka, which was a center of temple architecture, you will find a lot of those temples, they have this Amalaka, okay? That is the disc right below the Kalasha of the temple. And that was also found by the archaeologists after 1992. Then on top of that, K.K. Mohammed points out there were 263 temple objects, including carvings of deities, carvings in terracotta, and all of these things found in the temple. That's 263 of those. That's evidence number four. Okay. Then evidence number five was totally damning. You know, there was a 12th century inscription that was dug out, and then it points out, and then it's a 20-line inscription, and it says, this is the temple of Vishnu Hari, who carried out the vata of Vali and Ravana. Okay, so that's a direct, it cannot be more explicit than that. This is a very direct reference to Sri Rama, because he kills Vali in the battle, and then he kills Ravana, the ten-headed Ravana, and that is written down in an inscription. And you may recall, when this was discovered, the first claim made by the charlatan Irfan Habib was that, this was fabricated by Archaeological Survey of India, and it was planted on the site of Babri Masjid. Do you remember that?
I know, but then the government at that time was, when the final findings came out, the UP had already come into existence.
Yeah, it had. And not only that, you know.
And the judgment by the Allahabad High Court was also given when the UPA was there.
Exactly. And even Irfan Habib himself, after making all this noise, had to go back and admit, yes, no, it actually came from the same site. Because, you know, based on epigraphic grounds, based on stylistic ground, you know, art historians weighed in, and, you know, all the genuine scholars, right, you know, B.B. Lal and everyone, they jumped in. And, you know, it was so embarrassing for Irfan Habib and that gang of four. Even they had to backtrack and admit. But this was a damning evidence, you know, that a 12th century inscription that tells, you know, who built this temple and who's the deity to whom it is dedicated. And it was the Janmasthan of Sri Rama, who had killed Vali and Ravana. And that inscription was there. And that's evidence number five. Then B.R. Mani points out that starting from 4th century AD, that site in Ayodhya, where Ram Janmabhoomi stands today, and where Babri Masjid was encroaching for 500 years, was a place of continuous worship. Okay, and they have dug out so much of evidence, and Meenakshi Jain talks about that. She also talks about that in the book Battle for Rama. And, you know, the evidence is so overwhelming that nobody should have denied it in the first place. Unfortunately, you know, we had a group of Marxist historians and an English media that colluded with them, and then they were peddling a very false narrative for some time. Of course, it did not last for too long, but then they were able to get along with some time. But the point here was, B.R. Mani points out that iconic images from the Shunga period, okay, which is even before 4th century, but Gupta period, there are massive numbers of iconic images. They have been found from the same site. That again,
I think we have to summarize these points because we need to go beyond Yasir Qazi also.
Oh, absolutely. Let's do that. Okay. So anyway, so the bottom line is, you know, that Ramjumi. So the bottom line is the evidence was overwhelming that there was a temple right there, and then which was demolished. Then right on top of that, mosque was built. Okay. So he was denying that, and then once again, you know, let me try to just address a couple of more arguments he makes, both of which are ridiculous. Then we'll go beyond that. And then Yasir Qazi says that the entire conflict started only after 1858, you know, after the First War of Independence or the Sipahi Mutiny, and no evidence of the temple exists. But then, you know, the evidence is so... And in fact, he even denies Ayodhya existed. He says no such place called Ayodhya existed. All one has to do is to look at Skanda Purana, look at Ayodhya Mahatmya, which was, you know, written in 1034 CE. And the entire section is about the glory of Ayodhya. And then Guru Nanak visits Ayodhya in 1510. And then, you know, he converts one of the Muslims
and
there.
When was Valmiki Ramayana written?
Of course, yeah. But I'm only talking about, right, in the contemporary period. We don't even have to go back to Valmiki Ramayana. Mm-hmm. But even in the contemporary period, right, and even, you know, the East India Company officials like William Finch, you know, Joanne DeLate, Thomas Herbert, and all of these guys, and even Jesuit priests like Joseph Tiefenthaler and, you know, Mentale and others, you know, French scholar Mentale and others, they come and then they repeatedly write. And all of this happens between 1600 and 1800. And all of them, they talk about a temple for Sri Rama, which is now in ruins. But still, Hindus are coming there and worshipping all the time. And then on auspicious days, like Ram Navami, thousands
of people gather. All this is recorded in the evidence.
Yeah, it's all of this recorded in the evidence. But, you know, you remember, like, you know, the someone like Yasir Qazi is addressing a Muslim audience who are ignorant. And, you know, he's peddling these lies, hoping nobody is going to go there and check it. Right. And then the final piece he makes is going to induce a law riot for you. Okay, he says he now wants to exculpate Babur. Okay, so, you know, we all know who Babur was. Okay, Babur was a Qazi. And, you know, very first year he comes to India in 1526, he demolishes a temple. We'll talk about it in a second. But then he says Babur was a great poet. Okay, and then Babur maintained a diary in the form of Babur Nama. And if he had really demolished the temple, you know, he would have recorded about that, and he makes no mention of that. Okay, and
actually, there are a few pages missing, I'm told.
Bilkul. So, you know, Meenakshi Jain talks about that. You know, actually, Meenakshi Jain makes two wonderful arguments around that. Okay, number one, Babur does not record every one of the incidents, even the important incidents in his life. One of that is the conquest of Samarkand, right, where he takes the help of a Shia chieftain, and then he goes and attacks Samarkand. He does not mention that in Babur Nama because he is a Sunni Muslim and he doesn't want to upset the Sunni clergy. So it's left out. And then same thing, when in 1526, he conquers, the first temple he destroys is that of Kalki Avatara. That's in Sambal. Okay, he goes there, he gets it destroyed. He does not mention that in Babarnama, but then his general, Mir Hind Beg, okay, he has left an inscription. He says, based on the firman of Babur, I have demolished this temple and I have erected a masjid in its place. Okay, so, and obviously, just because Babur does not make an explicit confession does not mean anything. But as you said, there are pages missing because Meenakshi Jain points out on the 2nd of April, 1528, Babur records he and his army have reached Ayodhya. Okay, then no recording is there until the 18th of September. Okay, those 5 months, everything is missing. Those pages are missing. That's when, who was his general?
Mir Baqi
destroys the mandir and then he builds the temple on top of that. And for Yasir Qadi, it does not matter. He says that, oh, if Babur had really destroyed the temple, he would have made a note of that. Well, if the pages are missing, then he's not going to make a note of it. And he has left many things out as well. And if that's the only way to...
There is an extensive local lore that records in detail all the battles that took place and how Babur came there after spending, after losing the battle at Bayana. There was this temple and there was this great master, Swami Shantanand. And some Sufi became his disciple. And the Sufi actually... He squealed on the whole business, and because he had also acquired some powers, Babur came to know of it, and he came to this guy called, I think, Maula Qazal Bakhsh
Abbas. Ah, correct, yeah.
Qazal Bakhsh Abbas. Okay, this guy, Qazal Bakhsh Abbas. So he's the one who reads a dua for Babur, and in lieu, he asks for the temple to be demolished.
Right.
And as is, I think we know from Prithviraj time, our people, they have never known their enemy. They're not very bright about discovering who the enemy is. That is the local lore that goes, and they have recorded 76 battles.
Yeah.
And the 1992 was 77th.
Right. And all of them did. And, you know, the interesting part is Babur comes in 1526, you know, the third battle of Panipat. And the very first deed he does is to go and destroy the mandir in Sambal, the Kalki Avatar mandir. So this was their mission. You know,
he calls himself a Ghazi. Abhas Maldiyar, who has just released a very, very good volume on Babur. He has read the Babarnama in the original Chaghatai Turkish translation, translated from original Chaghatai Turkic language, not from the Persian translation of it. So these things come out very, the Babur's character comes out very plain.
Right.
He is a fanatic Muslim, simple as
Correct.
That.
Correct. Indeed.
So let's go beyond.
I have seen with a lot of the Momins in the West, and even some of the secular white people, you know, the so-called liberal.
Yes, let's go to some of the secular white people.
So
Momin argument we have shared.
Momin argument to dekh liya. Some of my, you know, secular white liberal friends, they were asking, you know, all these things happened 500 years back. What's the point of rewriting history? Okay, so. Look, I gave them the response. First of all, for us, it's a sacred site, but we don't have to do all these things. You know, the Muslims could have just come and told, we don't endorse the deeds of Mughals and other sultans. They came and demolished 40,000 temples. We don't support any of that. Don't hold us accountable. And as a gesture of goodwill, we will return 108 sites to you. Okay, choose any 108 temples. Okay, and then go and rebuild your temples. And I said that would have been the perfect solution. Perfect harmony would have prevailed. And, you know, we Hindus, usually we bend over backwards to accommodate our enemies. And we would have said, acha, aapne 108 mandir hame wapas de diya, then we will help you build 108 mosques. Okay, we are suicidal. We would have done that in all likelihood. Okay, so that would have been perfect harmony. But they did not do that. And to get a single temple back, we have been fighting for 500 years. And just the lawsuits, it started with 1858 complaint, right? When that person signs it, this is Masjid e Janamstan. Okay. And here someone has come and desecrated. So that's when the cases start. Okay. The rudimentary aspects of the case start. So we had to fight for some like 170 years to get one temple back. So now we are not going to back out. Okay. We want all the 40,000 temples back. Okay. So
this 40,000 is an exaggeration, of course.
We don't know that. Okay. So because see,
no, the point because there is only one documentation. You see, the documentation is done by Sitaram Goyal.
Not only Sitaram Goyal, but also, you know,
the documents about 1800 and 1900. It's he says it's a preliminary
document. It's a preliminary one, but there is another book which also summarizes that. Elliot and Dawson, you know, they summarize from all the Islamic sources the temples that were demolished and everywhere. Of course, the Muslims could have exaggerated the claims when they say in Varanasi they demolished 1,000 temples. Were they exaggerating? Where some of those very small temples and also some of the temples are complexes. You know, a complex would have had sannidhis for different deities and they might have counted those as different temples. But the point being, thousands of temples are erased. Okay, sorry, thousands of temples are raised and mosques were stood up on top of that. And a lot of the temple properties were stolen. Okay, so we are going to want every one of those back. So we are not going to stop with getting three of
them. Yes, I think we need to do extensive work on that.
We have to.
It's not good enough to just say that, okay, there are 40,000 temples. You have to prove those 40,000 temples. So therefore, I think it's wise to concentrate on the documentation that's already done by Sitaram
Goyal and others. And Elliot Dawson also has pretty good documentation. You know, if you leave out the numbers,
my point is that Sitaram Goyal, he consulted Elliot and Dawson.
Correct.
It's his research is very extensive, and he's consulted all the Islamic sources, and after that, and then from the ground, and then he has reached these numbers. And they're about 1900.
It's not comprehensive, though. I'll tell you why.
Comprehensive. He was supposed to do more.
I'll tell you why. Like, for example. I forgot the name of the author and I will share it in the, you know, notes at the bottom. Like when Tipu Sultan waged a campaign in Malabar coast in Kerala, he raised about 320 temples. Okay, those have been documented by a Keralite scholar. Okay, so with the list of the temples, the dates when they were demolished by Tipu Sultan and what kind of massacres were carried out along with that. So a lot of those do not figure in Sitaram Goyal's list. And similarly, the list of temples that Malik Kafur raised in South India. So those also do not figure in that list entirely. So yes, but I agree with you. Your point is well taken. You know, we have to be very thorough with the numbers. But even if you're going super conservative, we are looking at well over 2,000 big temples that were raised.
Maybe at 2,000 at the very minimum.
Yeah, exactly. So that was the reaction. I think the bottom line is... lot of the Mumins are imploding and a lot of the liberal Westerners, they are now dumbfounded because what they are seeing is Hindu resurgence because they also recognize this temple that's coming up is not happening in a void, right? So with Modi, a temple is coming up in Janamstan and Modi is going to UAE and he's inaugurating the temple and Boeing and Airbus are coming to Gujarat and manufacturing Apache helicopter and the airplanes and everything. So they recognize...
There's one coming up in Bahrain as well.
In Bahrain as well, yeah, that's the next temple coming up there, right? So, but what they are seeing is a convergence of India's economic prosperity and India's self-assertiveness as a Hindu civilization. Okay, so at some point, the way I understand the white liberals, you know, they tilt in the direction the wind blows. Okay, and if they figure that look, the Hindus are on the ascendancy, you know, they will wo to chup chap rahenge uske baad.
Quite right. What about the Western media?
They have not covered it much, except the usual slight remarks that come in, New York Times and other things, and very negative coverage, which is, you know, how we demolished the temple and how the Hindutva, the Hindu nationalist right, is, you know, asserting itself and how all of this has threatened the Muslim minorities of India and all of these usual stories. But this is not a story which is going to even... strike as novel to anyone, not even to the white Americans, because this is a story they've been telling all the time. Okay, there's nothing new. Okay, even the verbiage they are using is nothing new.
Quite right. So, what do we say in conclusion? The Ram Mandir has been a great civilizational resurgence as far as India is concerned and a civilizational shock to the rest of the world.
Both of those are very true. And I think I'm also looking a little deeper than that. I think, you know, what I would do is I will use the words of K.K. Mohammed, you know, archaeologist, kind of paraphrase him. The way he puts it is, look, Hindus are a very generous, very large-hearted people. He gives an example. You know, Akbar gives a farman to some of the sannyasis in Hanumangadi, you know, near Ayodhya, near the Mandir. And then along with that, he hands over the site of a dilapidated mosque. Okay, and that mosque is no longer in use. And as part of that donation, they get it. And then a couple of centuries later, some Muslims come and ask them, you know, Swamiji, Santjis, can we offer some prayers here? And then they not only agree, and they say, we'll actually renovate that part of the mosque so that you guys can go and do prayer. So KK Mohammed says, this is the generosity Hindus have always shown. And it's time we Muslims reciprocated that. And, you know, I think the message I have is in 1989 or until 1989, especially in the 80s, a lot of Muslims were willing to hand over Ram Janmabhoomi, right? The Babri Masjid to Hindus. In fact, the Masjid wouldn't even have been demolished. They agreed because that was never a place of worship for them. It was never a functioning mosque throughout history. And they also recognized, look, it was built on a temple. It's a very important temple for Hindus. It's Ram Janmabhoomi. Hindus have always worshipped. Can we give it back? And it was the Marxist historians who went and brainwashed them and told them, don't give it to them. Okay. And Mohammed says, they destroyed a society. That's the phrase, you know, KK Mohammed uses. So I think my message is, I don't care about the Marxist historians. You know, they are worse than prostitutes. You know, they don't have any scruples. They will do anything to lay waste to society because that way they can get a bit of kick out of that. But for Muslims, I'll say this, right? And for Muslims, Sri Rama is part of your heritage too. Your ancestors are converted, you know, by sword. And then that's not your fault. You know, whether you remain Muslim today or not, that's a different story. I wish you come back. I wish you did a garh wapsi. But even if you do not, Sri Rama, Ramayana, Mahabharata, Hinduism, everything is part of your heritage. Okay, so, you know, you don't have to become a Muslim fundamentalist. And if Hindus have been so accommodative of you, then you can reciprocate that. And don't be misled by the Marxists, the fundamentalists, and then living room jihadis like Yasir Qadhi and others. Instead, think of yourself. You know, think of yourself as part of dharmic landscape. You know, a great civilization called India, and you are part of that, and reciprocate that. Because if you don't reciprocate, Hindus have begun asserting themselves, we'll still come out on top. But if you reciprocate, we'll together come out on top.
Quite right. I think that's a very, very optimistic note on which to end this discussion today.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think this Ram Janmabhoomi thing has been, I think, a very, very uplifting event.
Yeah.
And it's probably been a real phenomenon. And maybe we can say that this is the inflection point.
This is the inflection point. And I am hoping, you know, today we'll be closing with Jai Shri Ram, but then very soon we'll be opening with Har Har Mahadev. Okay, jab Gyan Vapi is returned to us, and then the Shivji
comes. And Jai Shri Krishna.
And Jai Shri Krishna follows right after that. And then in Sambal. Okay, that should be the fourth for us. Okay, Sambal mein Kalki Avatar ka mandir. Okay, Jai Kalki Avatar. That will be the fourth one. Okay, then, you know, we can keep adding. Four for the time being will do. Okay.
Quite right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And Jai Shri Ram.
Jai Shri Ram.
Yeah, thank you.